So you sent us this incredibly dense, paradigm-shifting academic white paper for a very specific reason.
Yeah, we should definitely get right into that.
Right, because when you wrote to us, you described this creeping, sinking feeling you've been having at work, and honestly, just in your daily life. You said you felt like you were constantly trying to prove you were human enough or, sick enough or productive enough to a piece of software.
Which is such a common feeling right now.
It really is. You described sitting there, staring at a drop-down menu on a medical form or a job application, and finding yourself contorting your actual messy lived reality just to fit into these predefined administrative boxes.
Like you're just a data point.
Exactly, just
Yeah.
a data point. And you asked us, am I losing my mind, or is the world actually designed to ignore me?
It is a profound question. And well, the short answer is no, you are not losing your mind. The friction you are feeling there is real.
It's very real.
You are actively being forced to translate your biological, emotional life into a format that a bureaucracy can actually digest. And if your reality doesn't perfectly match the options in that drop-down menu,
The system simply renders you invisible.
exactly. It just erases you.
So that is exactly what we are getting into today. We are doing a deep dive specifically for you to show you the systemic architecture behind that exact feeling of alienation.
Yeah, and the source material for this is fascinating.
It is. The paper you sent us was published in June 2026 by Dr. Bechara Sahetli, who is an internal medicine physician, but he decided to zoom way, way out. The title is A World Waiting to Be Brought Forth: From Unit of Science to Life Coherent Civilization.
It's quite a title.
It is a mouthful, but it is, without exaggeration, an attempt to diagnose the ultimate crisis beneath the crises.
Which is an incredibly ambitious undertaking. I mean, when we look out at the world right now, we are confronted by a barrage of emergencies.
Just nonstop.
Right. We see climate destabilization accelerating. We see chronic illness skyrocketing despite all our medical advancements.
Yeah.
We see the very real existential risks of artificial intelligence, extreme wealth inequality, and really the fragmentation of basic social trust.
Right. And the way we normally handle these things on the news or, in politics is by putting them into completely different filing cabinets.
Oh, absolutely.
We have the climate change desk, we have the healthcare desk, the tech regulation desk. We act like they are totally unrelated problems requiring totally unrelated policies.
But Dr. Sinhuli argues that treating them as separate is actually a symptom of the very disease causing them.
Wait, really?
Yeah, they are not separate at all. They all stem from a fundamental structural disorder in our underlying worldview. They share a common root.
Okay.
And the argument here is that if we want to survive, if we want to build a civilization that actually sustains life rather than slowly chewing it up and spitting it out as profit, we have to understand and dismantle what he calls the mechanistic worldview.
The mechanistic worldview. Okay, so let's start right there, because this isn't just some abstract philosophy, right?
Yeah.
It is the operating system of the modern world.
It really is.
So how did we get here, and what does it actually mean to view the world as a machine?
So to understand the mechanistic worldview, you really have to look back a few hundred years to the scientific revolution. Think of thinkers like René Descartes and Isaac Newton.
Classic physics guys.
Right. They gave us an incredibly powerful framework for understanding physics. The idea was that the universe is essentially a giant clockwork mechanism. It's made of separate, inert parts that interact through predictable, measurable forces.
Which, I mean, that was incredibly useful for building bridges or steam engines or launching
Oh,
rockets.
incredibly useful. If a machine breaks, the logic is simple. You isolate the broken part, you take it out, you put a new one in, and the machine works again.
Makes total sense for a car.
Right. But the problem is that over the last few centuries, human institutions decided to take that exact framework, which is great for physics and engineering, and apply it to literally everything. Yeah. We began to treat ecosystems merely as external resources, like a warehouse of spare parts to be extracted. We began to treat human beings as consumers or data profiles. We began to treat living organisms, including the human body, as biochemical machines.
And when you view the world as just a collection of separate parts, you act as if you can impact one part without touching the rest.
Exactly.
Like we separate the economy from the ecology it sits inside of, as if the stock market just exists in a vacuum in outer space.
Right.
We separate physical health from the social conditions that actually create the illness.
And we have to ask why we do that. I mean, we do it because separation is highly convenient for running massive centralized systems.
How so?
Well, it allows a multinational corporation to completely separate its quarterly profit margins from, say, the depletion of the topsoil in the country it operates in. It allows a hospital system to separate an acute medical episode like an asthma attack from the fact that the patient lives right next to a polluting highway. The mechanistic worldview gives institutions permission to say, I only need to look at the part I can measure, control, and monetize.
But the things we choose to ignore don't just vanish. I think the paper explicitly states, what is excluded does not disappear.
Yes.
It just comes back to haunt us. The pollution we ignore returns as chronic disease. The soil depletion returns as a food shortage.
That is the core of the crisis beneath the crises. It is this ever-widening, catastrophic gap between the actual, messy, interconnected realities that sustain biological life and the clean, isolated abstractions our institutions use to organize their power.
Wow.
And this gap is what drives a phenomenon Dr. Selle calls the Great Inversion.
The Great Inversion. Okay, this concept is so clarifying. Walk us through how institutions invert.
Think about the origin story of any human institution. Like, why did we invent them in the first place?
Solve a problem, right?
Exactly. We created economies to provision life, to figure out how to grow food, build shelters, and distribute them so people don't freeze or starve. We created healthcare systems to protect and extend human health. We created educational systems to enlarge human understanding and pass down knowledge. Originally, these institutions were created as means.
Tools.
Yes, they were tools, and human life was the end goal.
The tool serves the user. Makes total sense.
But over time, as these institutions grow massive and complex, a structural inversion occurs. The means become the ends. Fast forward to today, the economy no longer exists to serve human life. Human lives and natural ecosystems are routinely sacrificed to protect market confidence or GDP growth.
Right.
Healthcare systems no longer center the patient. Patients and doctors are forced to adapt to incredibly rigid, standardized administrative billing pathways. Education no longer centers actual enlightenment. It organizes a student's entire childhood around institutional metrics and standardized tests.
The relationship has completely flipped. Life is now expected to serve the system. The system demands that biological life adapt to ensure the institution's survival. And the mechanism that drives this, like the way the system forces us to adapt, is through something the paper calls proxy capture.
Proxy capture is the engine of the Great Inversion. Let's break down how it works.
Yeah, please.
If you are managing a massive system, say a national school system or a huge hospital network, you cannot possibly know every single student or patient personally. You need indicators. You need proxies to measure whether you are actually succeeding.
And a proxy is just a stand-in for reality, right?
Right. But proxy capture happens when the indicator stops being a measurement of the goal and becomes the actual target itself.
I want to ground this because I think everyone listening has experienced this at their job at some point.
Definitely.
A few years ago, I had a friend who worked in a massive customer service call center. And when they started, the goal of the department was solve the customer's problem. That is a real qualitative life function.
Yes, a good goal.
But management couldn't easily measure problem solved on a spreadsheet, so they introduced a proxy. Average handle time, AHT.
Oh, no.
Yeah. They decided a good call is one that lasts under 4 minutes.
A classic proxy.
Within 6 months, proxy capture completely took over. My friend told me that agents realized the only way to keep their jobs and get their bonuses was to keep their AHT down. So if they got a complex call from an elderly person who was confused about their bill, the agents would literally just hang up on them.
Wow.
Or they would transfer them to a dead extension. The AHT metric looked phenomenal. The spreadsheet was completely green. Management celebrated. But the underlying reality, the actual customer's life, was demonstrably worse. The proxy became the entire goal.
That is a perfect and honestly terrifying example of proxy capture. And it happens at every level of society.
Yeah.
Think about education. The proxy is the standardized test score.
Right.
We know that critical thinking and emotional intelligence are vital for a healthy life, but you can't easily put those on a Scantron. So schools optimize for the test. They cut recess, they cut music, they literally teach to the test. Educational attainment is reduced entirely to the proxy.
And what about in healthcare? Because Dr. Serley is a physician, how does proxy capture work there?
Well, in the American healthcare system, one of the most powerful proxies is the RVU, or relative value unit.
I've heard of that. What is it?
It is a metric used to determine how much a doctor's labor is worth for billing purposes. Performing a procedure, like a biopsy, generates a lot of RVUs. Sitting with a patient, holding their hand, and taking an hour to uncover a complex, hidden environmental cause for their illness.
That generates very few RVUs.
Exactly. Almost none.
So the system financially punishes the doctor for providing deep relational care.
Yes. The hospital administrators look at the dashboard. They tell the doctors they need to see a patient every 12 minutes to maximize RVU throughput. The proxy is optimized. The hospital's revenue goes up. But the doctor burns out, and the patient feels like they were shoved through a car wash without anyone actually listening to them.
The institution succeeds while the life it is supposed to serve just deteriorates.
That's the great inversion.
I was trying to come up with a visual for this. Imagine you are driving a car and you are staring exclusively at your GPS screen on the dashboard.
Okay.
The GPS is your proxy for the real world. The line on the screen says, go straight. But if you just looked up out the windshield, you would see the bridge is out and there is a giant lake right in front of you.
Right.
Because of proxy capture, you don't look up. You drive straight into the lake, proudly announcing as you sink, I followed the route perfectly. My metrics were flawless.
That is a strong analogy, but we actually have to push it a little further to understand the real malice of the mechanistic worldview.
Pass.
In your analogy, the driver eventually gets wet, right? The feedback of reality eventually intrudes. But in our society, if the map so clearly doesn't match the territory, we have to ask, why did the people running these systems refuse to look out the windshield?
Right. Why do they keep driving into the lake?
Because the people designing the route aren't the ones in the car.
Oh.
They aren't getting wet. The mechanistic worldview is fundamentally an architecture of power and control. Remember, what can be separated can be owned. What can be quantified can be priced. What can be standardized can be administered from a great distance.
Ah. So the CEO of the hospital network, or the private equity manager who owns the veterinary clinics, they are sitting in an office thousands of miles away just looking at a dashboard.
Exactly. The negative feedback, the getting wet, the burnout, the environmental collapse, the patient suffering is completely displaced onto someone else. The institutions have achieved what Dr. Safely calls an operational achievement of separation.
Operational achievement.
Yeah. They have built massive systemic filters that block out any feedback from the affected persons or ecosystems that cannot be translated into their chosen metrics.
Yeah.
They protect their own internal coherence by structurally ignoring the real-world consequences that would challenge their legitimacy.
That is incredibly dark, but it explains so much about why sending a complaint to a massive corporation feels like shouting into a void.
It's designed that way.
So if the mechanistic model, this worldview of isolated parts, standardized metrics, and disconnected consequences, is the root disease, what is the cure? The paper introduces a concept called unitive science, heavily referencing the work of a thinker named Jude Curvin.
Yes.
And it proposes that the universe isn't a bunch of separate parts at all.
That's right. Curvin's unitive science acts as a direct worldview-level counter-narrative to the mechanistic model. It challenges the inherited Newtonian image of reality as just a collection of separate, inert objects bumping into each other in a dead void. Instead, it presents a universe that is fundamentally relational, informational, interconnected, and evolutionarily emergent.
The paper refers to it as a cosmology of belonging, which honestly sounds like a breath of fresh air.
It is.
The idea is that we aren't just isolated meat machines competing for resources on a rock. We are expressions of a cosmic history, fundamentally entangled with everything around us.
And it is a very powerful and necessary intervention. Shifting from a cosmology of separation to a cosmology of belonging has the capacity to awaken wonder, humility, and a sense of shared participation in reality.
Yeah.
But, and this is important, this is where we have to be very careful and where Dr. Thoroughly introduces a massive, crucial note of caution.
Right. Because this paper does not just swallow the unitive science movement whole. It actually offers a really rigorous critique of it.
Yes, and the critique is vital if we want to build something real and not just a New Age fantasy. The paper warns us against a very common cognitive trap called epistemic blending.
Epistemic blending. Okay, epistemology is the study of how we know what we know, right? So how do people blend it?
Dr. Saheeli breaks knowledge down into four distinct epistemic levels. The problem happens when people carelessly mix up these different levels as if they carry the exact same weight of truth.
Okay, let's go through these four levels because I feel like this is a great toolkit for anyone trying to navigate science news or, you know, wellness trends. What is level one?
Level one consists of established empirical findings. These are the proven scientific facts, things that have been peer-reviewed, tested, and verified.
Like what?
For example, The fact that DNA encodes genetic information,
yeah.
or the mathematical reality of quantum entanglement.
Got it.
Level two involves active scientific hypotheses. These are the frontier ideas. They're grounded in science, but they are currently being debated and tested. Think of string theory or holographic descriptions of space-time. They might be true, but the jury's still out.
So level one is fact. Level two is a highly educated mathematical guess.
Correct. Let me move to level three. Philosophical interpretations. This is how we try to make sense of the science.
Mm.
If physics shows us that particles are entangled, a level three interpretation might be adopting a relational ontology, which is the philosophical position that relationships are more fundamental than the things themselves.
That makes sense.
And finally, level four, metaphysical or spiritual commitments. This is a leap of faith or a grand narrative, like claiming the entire universe is a single conscious mind or everything happens for a reason.
So epistemic blending is when someone reads a headline about a level one empirical finding in physics and uses it to instantly justify a level four spiritual commitment,
yeah.
completely bypassing the actual science.
Precisely. And it happens constantly. The paper gives a brilliant example regarding the 2022 Nobel Prize in Physics.
Okay, hold up. I remember reading about that Nobel Prize. It had something to do with quantum mechanics and Bell inequalities. But before we talk about how people misinterpret it, can you give me an ELI 5, you know, explain it like I'm 5 on what exactly those physicists proved? Because Bell inequalities sounds incredibly intimidating.
I will do my best. So in the world of classical mechanistic physics, things only affect each other locally. If I want to move a coffee cup, I have to physically touch it or hit it with something. Einstein believed this applied to everything. He hated the idea of what he called spooky action at a distance.
Right, things can't just magically move.
But quantum mechanics suggested something weird, that two particles, say two electrons, could become entangled. Meaning, if you measure the spin of one electron here on Earth, you instantly know the spin of its entangled partner, even if that partner is on the other side of the galaxy.
Which implies they are communicating faster than the speed of light, which breaks all the rules.
Exactly. So for decades, physicists wondered, are they actually communicating instantly, or is there some hidden local variable we just can't see? Like two people opening matching envelopes that were packed years ago.
Okay.
John Bell came up with a mathematical theorem, Bell's inequalities, to test this.
Mm.
And the physicists who won the 2022 Nobel Prize conducted experiments proving, definitively, that Bell's inequalities are violated. Meaning, there are no hidden variables. The particles are genuinely entangled. The state of one instantly correlates with the state of the other, regardless of distance. It is a profound, paradigm-shattering, level one empirical finding. It proves the universe is not entirely local.
Okay, that is wild. But how does the epistemic blending happen here?
Proponents of certain unitive or New Age frameworks take that level one finding particles are non-locally entangled, and they immediately jump to a level four metaphysical claim. They say, quantum physics proves the universe is a single, unified conscious entity, and therefore my thoughts can manifest reality.
Ah. They take a highly specific mathematical relationship between subatomic particles and blow it up to mean the universe is a giant brain that listens to my vision board.
Right. The science simply does not prove that. The paper brings up another great example involving Landauer's principle.
What is Landauer's principle?
It is a principle in physics that proves there's a thermodynamic cost to erasing information. If you have a physical system, like a computer chip, and you erase a bit of data, it must release a tiny amount of heat into the environment. It proves a fundamental physical link between information processing and energy.
That makes sense. Your laptop gets hot when it's processing or overwriting data.
Right. It's a proven level one reality. But some people commit what Dr. Seekley calls semantic inflation. They leap from the physical, mathematical definition of information to the idea that the universe is sending us semantic, meaningful messages. They conflate physical data with human meaning.
It's like finding a puddle on the sidewalk that happens to be shaped like a smiley face and concluding that the rainstorm is actively trying to cheer you up.
That is exactly what semantic inflation is. Mm. Physical information is not the same as semantic meaning, which is certainly not the same as existential purpose.
No.
The paper is warning us that epistemic humility, keeping these four levels distinct, doesn't destroy the wonder of the universe. It actually protects the integrity of the science. If we just mash it all together, we lose the ability to think clearly.
But the paper's biggest issue with unitive science isn't just about mixing up physics and philosophy. It's an ethical problem.
Yeah.
It's what the author calls the crucial limitation. And this is the part of the paper that really stopped me in my tracks, because we hear it all the time, especially in wellness spaces or in progressive corporate retreats. We are all connected. We are all one. It's presented as the ultimate, unassailable moral high ground.
The problem is that interconnection, on its own, is not inherently good.
Right. I want to dig into this because it challenges so many assumptions. The paper points out that a biological tumor is highly connected to its host.
Very connected.
It is dynamically integrated. It is constantly drawing blood, nutrients, and signaling molecules from the body. It is deeply one with the host, but it is killing the host.
Or consider a massive extractive global market. It is incredibly interconnected. It intimately links a cobalt miner working in horrific conditions in the Congo to a supply chain in Shenzhen, to a tech CEO in Silicon Valley, to a consumer in New York. The system is a marvel of unitive connection.
Or a mass surveillance system in a totalitarian state. Everyone is connected. Everyone's data is pooled together into a single unified system. That is the definition of interconnection.
This raises the most important question of the paper. If unity, coherence, and connection can describe a deadly tumor, an exploitative market, or a totalitarian state just as accurately as they describe a healthy old-growth forest, then unity is not enough. Coherence is not morally determinate.
I have to say, I love this pushback on the romanticization of oneness, because if we just go around telling everyone we are all one, there's no separation, doesn't that actually erase real victims and real power imbalances?
It completely erases them.
Think about it. If a massive chemical company is dumping toxic waste into a river and a working class family downstream is getting rare forms of cancer, telling that family, hey, remember, we are all one with the chemical company, feels like a vicious insult. It feels like a way to shut them up.
It is worse than an insult, actually. It is a mechanism of complicity. Unity can be, and often is, weaponized by the powerful. When we declare we are all responsible for the state of the world, we are distributing the moral burden equally across actors who have radically unequal causal power.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The family downstream did not cause the pollution, but the rhetoric of oneness asks them to share the metaphysical blame with the CEO.
If the universe is one, we still have to ask, whose rules are we playing by inside that oneness?
And crucially, this uncritical unitive thinking can lead to what psychologists call spiritual bypassing. This is when people who are suffering from active injustice, abuse, or structural violence are told by spiritual leaders or wellness influencers to transcend their division, to let go of their anger, and to realize their oneness with their oppressors before they have received any truth, safety, accountability, or material repair.
It's using spirituality as an anesthetic to avoid doing the hard work of justice.
Exactly.
So if pure connection isn't the answer, we need something more. We need a rigorous way to evaluate whether a connection is actually good or whether it's malignant.
And this is where Dr. Seely pivots to the core framework of the paper. He introduces the life coherence corrective.
Okay, life coherence corrective.
If unitive science says we are all connected, life coherence says, fine, but what is this connection actually doing to the physical, biological lives involved? And to build this framework, the paper brings in three incredibly powerful, heavy-hitting concepts.
Let's hear them.
The first is from the Chilean biologist Humberto Maturana. It is the concept of living autonomy and autopoiesis.
Autopoiesis. That is a heavy academic word. What does it mean?
It breaks down into auto, meaning self, and poiesis, meaning creation or making. Maturana and Francisco Varela coined this term to describe how living systems fundamentally differ from machines. An organism isn't just an object that was assembled in a factory. It is an autopoietic unity. That means it continuously produces the very components and the boundaries that maintain its own identity.
Okay, can we visualize this like a single cell?
Exactly. Think of a living cell. The cell membrane, the wall around it, isn't just a static barrier. It is constantly being produced and repaired by the metabolic chemical network inside the cell. And in turn, that membrane protects the metabolic network so it can keep producing the membrane. It is a self-creating loop.
And the membrane is a boundary, which is fascinating because in a lot of unitive New Age circles, boundaries are viewed as the enemy. You hear things like, boundaries are illusions of the ego. We need to dissolve our boundaries to merge with the universe.
But Maturana shows us biologically that boundaries are not illusions. They are the absolute prerequisite for life. Without a membrane, the cell dissolves into the environment and dies. Boundaries are necessary for healthy relationships.
I was trying to explain this to a friend, and I used the analogy of a house party. Saying boundaries are bad is like saying the walls of a house are bad and we should tear them down to be more connected to the neighborhood.
Right.
But the boundaries, the walls, the doors, the roof, the invitation list are what actually make the party possible. It creates a space of warmth, music, and safety. Without those boundaries, it isn't a party anymore. It's just a vulnerable mob standing in an open field exposed to the freezing rain. You need the walls to have the party. You need the membrane.
That is a very grounded, practical way to view it. A biological membrane, an immune system, a psychological personal boundary, a culture's sovereign territory, or the legal right to bodily consent. These do not prevent connection. They regulate openness.
They regulate it.
They prevent total closure, which would lead to starvation. But they also prevent uncontrolled invasion, which would lead to death. They make sure the interaction doesn't destroy the organism.
You know, for anyone listening to this right now, it really makes you think about your own boundaries. How often does society or your family or your workplace tell you to be a team player, to be open, to give more of yourself? Can what you actually need in that moment is a healthy, firm, autopoietic membrane to protect your own life?
And protecting your life brings us to the second foundational thinker in the paper, the Canadian philosopher John McMurtry, and his concept of life value. Because if Maturana gives us the necessity, the boundary, McMurtry gives us the metric.
Right. Earlier, we talked about how institutions use proxies like test scores or GDP or RVUs. If we are throwing out those mechanistic metrics, what do we replace them with? How do we measure if a society is actually succeeding?
McMurtry argues that we have to go down to the bedrock. Life itself is the enabling ground of all value. Think about it. Every human preference, every economic market, every technological invention, every piece of art presupposes living beings who have the capacity to feel, think, move, and relate.
Without life, there is no value.
Therefore, something has positive value if it enables, protects, or enlarges life capacity. And it has negative value if it disables or destroys life capacity.
And the paper is very careful to define life capacity tangibly. It's not just a vague feeling of happiness. It defines it as physiological integrity, nourishment, movement, cognition, meaningful agency, and care. These are real physical and psychological realities.
Yes. It provides an objective standard,
right,
but one that does not enforce cultural uniformity.
What do you mean by that?
For example, caloric nourishment is a universal objective necessity to maintain life capacity. If you don't eat, you die. But the cultural forms of that nourishment, the cuisines, the spices, the rituals of eating, vary wildly and beautifully across the globe. Belonging is a universal necessity, but the cultural structures of family and community vary. Life value secures the universal root while allowing for diverse branches.
And McMurtry contrasts this life value with what he calls the money sequence. He says the life sequence is when you use resources as a means to enlarge life capacity. Like, I use money to buy food, to feed my family so they can grow and thrive.
Exactly.
But the money sequence is when you use money simply to make more money, and you treat life simply as a friction cost to be minimized.
Let's look at a systemic example of the money sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at private equity firms buying up veterinary clinics, which has been a massive trend.
Oh, I've heard about this.
In the life sequence, a veterinary clinic exists to enlarge the life capacity of the animals and provide care. Money is just a tool the local vet uses to buy x-ray machines, hire staff, and keep the lights on. The goal is the animal's health.
But when private equity takes over, the inversion happens.
Exactly. Under the money sequence, the clinic is no longer a place of healing. It is an asset whose sole purpose is to generate an escalating return on investment. The firm cuts veterinary technicians to save labor costs. They institute quotas for how many tests a vet must upsell to a pet owner. The life capacity of the animals, the emotional well-being of the staff, and the financial stability of the pet owners all plummet.
But the money sequence expands.
That is the great inversion in action. The institution survives by chewing up the life it relies on.
So we have Maturana's boundaries, we have McMurtry's life value, and the third piece of this corrective framework is Johann Galtung's concept of structural violence.
Galtung was a pioneer in peace studies, and he fundamentally changed how we understand violence. When we normally think of violence, we think of a direct physical act, somebody punching someone else in the face, an army invading a town. Galtung called that direct violence.
Okay.
But he realized that limiting our definition to direct physical acts misses the vast majority of human suffering. So he identified structural violence.
How does he define it?
Structural violence occurs when social, economic or legal arrangements produce avoidable gaps between someone's actual life capacity and their potential life capacity. It is violence built into the architecture of the system.
The example Dr. Sahila uses in the paper is heartbreaking, but it makes the concept crystal clear.
Yeah, share that.
If a child is killed by a stray bullet, society immediately recognizes that as a tragedy and an act of violence. But if a child dies of a preventable disease because life-saving medicine is kept artificially unaffordable due to international patent monopolies, society just records that as a medical statistic, is viewed as a sad fact of nature.
But Galtung points out that it is not a fact of nature. The causal structure of that patent monopoly is just as organized, just as deliberate, as the firing of a bullet. And the result, the loss of the child's life capacity, is identical. The economic arrangement itself is structurally violent.
But because there isn't one specific bad guy pulling a trigger, because it's dispersed across a boardroom of shareholders and patent lawyers, it becomes invisible.
And to keep it invisible, society utilizes what Galtung called cultural violence. These are the narratives, the myths, and the ideologies we use to justify and legitimize the structural violence.
Like the myth of total meritocracy, saying, well, if that family worked harder, they could have afforded the premium health insurance, so it's really a tragedy of their own making.
Exactly.
Or the narrative that intellectual property must be protected at all costs to incentivize innovation, even if the cost is a child's life.
Precisely. Poverty is reframed as a personal moral failure rather than an economic design flaw. Ecological destruction is reframed as necessary development. Civilian casualties in war are rebranded as collateral damage. The cultural narrative sanitizes the violence, making it acceptable to the general public.
So if structural and cultural violence are the reality of the mechanistic worldview, what is the opposite? What does peace look like in a life-coherent framework?
Galtung made a crucial distinction between negative peace and positive peace. Negative peace is simply a ceasefire. It is the absence of direct violence. The guns stop firing, the bombing stops.
Which is good.
Which is necessary, yes, but insufficient. Because in a negative peace, the oppression, the starvation, the patent monopolies, the structural violence remains entirely intact.
It's a peace that only benefits the people who are already comfortable.
Yes. Positive peace, on the other hand, is the active presence of conditions that actually support and enlarge life. It is the dismantling of structural violence.
And the paper ties this idea of positive peace directly to McMurtry's idea of the civil commons.
The civil commons are the tangible, shared institutions that secure universal access to the conditions of life, regardless of someone's purchasing power. Public health systems that provide care to everyone. Clean water infrastructure. Universal public education. Open public libraries. Environmental protections that keep the air breathable. Positive peace is not a state of mind. It requires the relentless construction and defense of a robust civil commons.
Okay, let's pause and synthesize this, because this triad of thinkers is profound. We started with this beautiful, unitive idea that the universe is interconnected. But Dr. Salicki is saying that philosophical connection must pass a material, physical test. Does your unitive philosophy actually make preventable suffering more visible? Does it help you identify unequal power dynamics? Does it compel you to build civil commons?
Right.
Because if your spirituality just makes you feel cozy and connected while structural violence continues unabated outside your window, it is useless.
It is worse than useless. It is an accessory to the violence. A universe of relations only becomes an ethical civilization when we use those relations to protect, restore, and enlarge life capacity.
Which brings us to what I consider the most terrifying part of this entire deep dive. We know what life value is now, we know what civil commons are, and we know we need them. So we have to ask the obvious question. Why do our modern, highly advanced institutions so consistently fail to deliver them? Why does the modern hospital burn out its best doctors and bankrupt its sickest patients? Why does the modern university crush its students with decades of debt while paying its adjunct professors poverty wages, all while sitting on a multi-billion dollar endowment?
The answer lies in a phenomenon the paper calls institutional autopoietization.
Okay, there is that word again. Autopoiesis, the cell making its own membrane. But now we are applying it to massive human institutions.
Yes, though the paper is careful to note, this is an analogy, not literal biological autopoiesis. But the pattern is identical. Organizations are initially created to serve a life function, healing, educating, governing. But as they grow, they hire lawyers of administration, they adopt complex metrics, and over time, they begin to reorganize themselves.
The inversion.
Right. Their primary operational function subtly shifts away from serving their founding purpose and shifts toward reproducing their own procedures, maximizing their revenue streams, protecting their authority, and ensuring their reputational survival.
Wait, so are you saying a modern university or a multinational hospital acts almost like a blind biological organism whose only instinct is to survive and grow, even if it means slowly consuming the host, which is the human beings it was supposed to serve?
That is exactly the dynamic. The paper calls it pathological coherence. A subsystem, the institution, achieves perfect internal coherence and successfully reproduces itself by actively degrading the larger life system upon which it depends.
That is horrifying. It's like a parasite that doesn't realize it's killing the animal it lives inside. How does an institution actually do this? What is the mechanism?
It happens through what Dr. Saley calls procedural capture. The institution stops looking at substantive reality and only looks at its own internal self-generated categories. Let's look at a human resources department at a massive corporation.
Okay.
An employee comes to HR because they are being emotionally abused by a manager. The employee is experiencing a severe loss of life capacity. They're losing sleep. Their health is failing.
A real human crisis.
But the institution does not see a human in pain. It sees a grievance file. It processes the file according to its internal liability protocols. The goal of HR is not to heal the employee. Hmm. The goal of HR is to protect the corporation from a lawsuit.
So the system responds to the existence of the feedback, but it completely ignores the meaning of the feedback.
Precisely. You file the grievance, the HR department logs it, holds a mediation meeting, checks the box that they processed it according to the manual, and closes the file. The manager gets a mild warning. Nothing fundamentally changes. The institution handled the procedure perfectly, maintaining its own coherence, while the life capacity of the worker continues to be crushed. The system is fundamentally deaf to the reality of life.
This is why the expert analysis in this paper focuses so heavily on a concept called corrigibility. Because if institutions are deaf, we have to figure out how to make them listen.
Corrigibility is perhaps the most important administrative concept in the entire paper. It means the ability to be corrected. Dr. Cecili argues that the central criterion for whether any institution is legitimate is its degree of corrigibility.
Let's define what that looks like in practice.
A corrigible institution has the structural capacity to receive evidence that it is causing harm. And this is the key. It actually alters its core operations, reallocates its budgets, and changes its rules to stop that harm. An incorrigible institution receives evidence of harm, and instead of changing, it hires a public relations firm to spin the feedback or employs lawyers to crush the people complaining.
I love this concept. It's like touching a hot stove. A healthy human nervous system is highly corrigible. You touch the burner, you feel pain, and you recoil your hand instantly to minimize tissue damage. An incorrigible institution turns off its pain receptors, it keeps its hand on the burner, and it watches its own flesh melt because it's decided that the smell of burning flesh is actually highly profitable.
That is a visceral but highly accurate analogy. A life-coherent institution must be designed like a healthy nervous system. It must have protected channels for dissent. It must have transparent information flows. And most importantly, the people who are actually affected by the harm, the patients, the students, the workers, the local community, must have the structural power to force this system to change. Without corrigibility, the institution is just a blind, self-replicating machine driving us toward a cliff.
So how do we fix it? We have spent the last half hour diagnosing the mechanistic disease. We've seen the limits of just being connected. We've mapped out how institutions become self-serving parasites through proxy capture and incorrigibility. Now we look at the cure. We look at Dr. Sella's actual roadmap for transformation.
Right.
In the white paper, there is a visual diagram titled From Unitive Reality to Life-Coherent Civilization. Let's walk through the four stages of this map. How do we get from here to there?
The first stage is unitive reality. This is the foundational worldview shifts we discussed earlier. It is the deep recognition of relationality, interdependence, and emergence. We have to acknowledge that we do not exist in isolated mechanistic silos, and that the universe is a profoundly entangled, generative place. It is the necessary cosmological starting line.
But as we established, we cannot stop there. So we move to the second stage, living autonomy.
Right. We move from the vastness of universal relation to recognizing the specific biological boundaries of actual living beings. We respect autopoiesis. We recognize what Maturana calls the legitimate other. We understand that difference, diversity, and protective boundaries are essential for a healthy coexistence, rather than trying to melt everyone into a homogeneous blob.
Which leads directly into the third stage, life-coherent value.
Here we apply McMurtry's standard. We reject the money sequence and the proxies of GDP or test scores. We focus entirely on protecting and enlarging life capacity and providing universal necessities. And we embrace a core principle, non-disposability.
Non-disposability. I want to highlight that. Because right now, Our economy treats almost everything as disposable. It means no worker is just a friction cost to be laid off to boost a quarterly stock price. No ecosystem is just a sacrifice zone for a mining company. No elderly person is just a drain on resources.
It is the ultimate rejection of the mechanistic mindset. And that leads to the final stage, civilizational praxis. This is where philosophy becomes concrete action. This is where we build the civil commons. We develop regenerative technologies that clean the air rather than pollute it. We establish positive peace by dismantling structural violence. And critically, this entire four-stage process is governed by a continuous feedback loop of institutional corrigibility.
The system has to be able to learn, admit error, and correct itself. And sitting right at the center of this map like a compass is what Dr. Saley calls the governing question. This is the ultimate test. It's the filter for every new law, every new technology, every corporate policy.
The governing question is demanding. It asks, does this way of participating protect, restore, or enlarge life capacity without transferring disabling costs to other lives, ecosystems, or future generations?
It is so rigorous. Because it's not enough for a tech CEO to say, look, our new food delivery app is amazing. It enlarges the life capacity of busy families by saving them time. Under this framework, you have to ask the second half of the question. Did you transfer disabling costs to gig workers who are paid below minimum wage and to the environment through massive plastic waste to make it happen? If the answer is yes, the app is not life coherent.
And what's vital here is how this framework handles the concept of global universalism. It doesn't demand that everyone on Earth adopt one single monolithic culture or religion. The paper emphasizes the concept of pluriversality.
Pluriversality, meaning many worlds.
Yes. It defines pluriversality as many worlds of meaning within one shared field of life dependence. We do not have to agree on metaphysics or theology or cultural traditions, but we all bleed red. We all depend on the exact same atmosphere, the same water cycle, the same topsoil, and the same basic physiological needs. We share the life ground. Therefore, no culture, no corporation, and no nation has the right to destroy the life conditions of others in pursuit of its own goals.
Okay, let's take this theoretical map, this beautifully structured sequence, and drag it down into the dirt of reality. How do we apply this governing question to the massive pillars of our society today? The paper specifically outlines applications for medicine, the economy, and education. Let's start with medicine, since Dr. Safely is a physician. What does life-coherent medicine actually look like?
Modern medicine has achieved absolute miracles. But under the mechanistic worldview, as we discussed with RVUs, the person often disappears. The complex human being is reduced to a specific organ, the organ is reduced to a biomarker on a lab test, and that biomarker becomes the sole target of the intervention. A life-coherent approach to medicine doesn't abandon the science or the lab tests, but it embeds them in a broader reality. It shifts the ultimate goal from merely treating the lab value to restoring the person's functional lived capacity.
There is a quote in the paper that sums this up perfectly. A treatment that fixes a lab value but destroys a patient's functional life is not life coherent.
Consider an elderly patient with mild hypertension. Mechanistic medicine might prescribe a powerful cocktail of drugs to lower their blood pressure to a mathematically perfect number. The proxy is optimized. But if those drugs make the patient so dizzy and fatigued that they can no longer walk around their neighborhood, play with their grandchildren, or think clearly, their actual life capacity has been severely disabled by the treatment. Life-coherent medicine requires relational care. It requires doctors to have the time and the mandate to understand the patient's entire context.
And structurally, it requires the healthcare system to function as a true civil commons, where access to care is dictated entirely by human need, not by an individual's purchasing power or insurance tier. Okay, let's move to the economy. The paper states, provisioning must precede accumulation.
The economy is, at its root, simply a system for organizing human labor to access the means of life. Markets can be highly efficient mechanisms for distributing certain goods. But under life coherence, the profitability of a market can never override universal human necessities. You cannot allow a system where people starve or freeze simply because they lack money, while simultaneously allowing infinite unchecked accumulation of wealth at the top.
The paper argues we need to massively reinvest in life capital things like regenerating topsoil, funding care networks, and expanding public health. And it demands boundary accountability, meaning corporations have to actually pay for the costs they currently displace onto the public, like carbon emissions or water pollution. But I have to push back here, or at least ask the cynical question.
Go for it.
We live in a global economy built entirely, 100%, on the money sequence and infinite accumulation. isn't telling a multinational corporation to focus on provisioning necessities rather than maximizing shareholder value, like telling a great white shark to switch to a kelp diet. It's just not in their DNA. They will just hire lobbyists to crush any life-coherent legislation.
That is the most essential critique of any reform movement, and the paper addresses it directly. Private virtue is not enough. You cannot just ask the shark to be nice, and you cannot rely on the moral awakening of CEOs. You have to structurally change what the paper calls the enabling constraints. You have to change the legal environment.
So you have to change the water the shark swims in, or take away its teeth.
Yes. The paper points toward different ownership structures entirely. It advocates for worker cooperatives, community land trusts, and commons-based models where the people affected by the enterprise are the ones governing it. And it requires strict legal frameworks revoking corporate charters for severe ecological damage, legally binding fiduciary duties to the environment, not just shareholders. It is about making life-serving actions structurally easy, and extractive action legally and economically impossible. The rules of the market must be explicitly subordinated to the biological requirements of life.
That is a massive paradigm shift. What about education? We talked earlier about proxy capture with standardized testing. How do we build life-coherent schools?
Education must move entirely beyond the mechanistic model of treating the student as an empty container to be filled with standardized testable data. True education is about forming capacities. It teaches young people how to distinguish truth from error, how to connect disparate ideas, and how to correct their own mistakes. And crucially, in the modern world, it must teach systems literacy.
Systems literacy. I think this is so important. Teaching students how the economy they will graduate into actually depends on the ecology they are currently destroying. Teaching them how algorithms and technologies redistribute power and attention. If we don't teach students how the invisible systems work, they will just become compliant gears in the mechanistic machine.
Exactly. The ultimate educational question in this framework is, does this practice, this curriculum, enlarge the learner's capacity to understand the world, relate to others, create meaning, and participate responsibly in the civil commons?
This brings us to the final frontier of the paper, because right now, human civilization is not just dealing with the slow decay of institutions. We are facing three massive, immediate, existential pressures that are accelerating everything we've talked about today. Artificial intelligence, ecological collapse, and the threat of global war. Let's start with AI, because the paper has a very specific structural warning about it.
The primary danger of AI, according to Dr. Salyut's framework, is not necessarily the sci-fi trope that it will wake up, become conscious, and decide to terminate humanity. The immediate, present-day danger is that AI is being forcefully dropped into institutions that are already suffering from extreme pathological coherence.
Right. Let's use the hospital example again. If a hospital network is already structurally optimizing for billing revenue over patient health, and you give them an advanced autonomous AI, the AI doesn't suddenly develop a conscience and say, hey, we should really care more about these sick people. It just amplifies the billing extraction by a factor of 10. It's like putting a massive rocket engine on a car that has no steering wheel. You aren't going to invent a new way to travel. You are just going to hit the wall of institutional autopilotization infinitely faster.
That is the exact risk, because capability is not the same thing as wisdom. AI amplifies the existing underlying objectives of the system. If the system is incorrigible, the AI makes it hyper-incorrigible. Furthermore, the paper highlights the massive risk of cognitive offloading. If we use AI to do all our thinking, our writing, our reading, and our analyzing, our own human capacity to understand and navigate the world biologically degrades. We lose our life capacity of cognition, and we absolutely cannot forget the material cost.
The physical reality of the cloud, we talk about AI like it's magic pixie dust in the ether.
But it is intensely physical. AI requires massive, sprawling data centers. It requires staggering amounts of electricity, millions of gallons of fresh water to cool the servers, and the extraction of rare earth minerals, often under horrific labor conditions. Assessing whether AI is life coherent requires us to look at those massive ecological and distributional costs, not just the convenience of the software generating an email for us.
I want everyone listening to think about how you use AI in your daily life right now. Does it enlarge your agency, your creativity, and your capacity to think deeply? Or does it enclose your agency, mediate what you see, and make you increasingly dependent on a proprietary platform owned by a billionaire? It is a vital question. The next existential pressure is ecology.
To survive ecological collapse, we have to recognize Earth not as an external environment that surrounds us like a backdrop on a stage, but as the literal life ground from which we are built. We are physically continuous with the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the microbial life in the soil. Under this view, ecological limits are not restrictions on human freedom. They are the enabling boundaries of life. A strict limit on fishing is not a punishment. It is the boundary that ensures there will be fish in the ocean next year.
And the paper ties this into the concept of good ancestry. We need to start treating future generations as legitimate others who have actual moral and legal standing right now. When human activity causes the extinction of a species, we are closing a pathway of evolutionary generative potential forever. We are literally stealing the richness of the life ground from our descendants.
Finally, the paper addresses peace and spirituality, because as resources become strained, the threat of war rises. Peace, in a life-coherent framework, is not just the interval between bombings. It is the absolute end of disposability. War requires immense cultural violence. It requires media narratives and political rhetoric that make entire populations killable or portray them as less than human. Life-coherent peace requires us to aggressively dismantle those narratives, distinguish co-perpetrators from general populations, and relentlessly pursue positive peace through civil commons.
And the spirituality piece is so important to touch on here at the end, because the paper offers a final warning against spiritual bypassing in the face of these crises.
Yes. A truly life-coherent spirituality does not ask oppressed people to transcend their anger while the harm against them continues. It does not blame chronic illness on a lack of positive consciousness. Contemplation, meditation, and unitive connection are profound human experiences. But inner calm does not, by itself, magically transform exploitative, incorrigible institutions. Material justice is where spiritual claims must become visible. Material justice is where spiritual claims become visible. I'm going to write that down and put it on my fridge. That is the entire paper in a sentence. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We started with the invisible danger of the mechanistic worldview, how it separates us, turns us into proxies, and forces life to serve the bureaucracy. We explored the limits of unitive science, how just being connected isn't enough if the connection is a parasite or an extractive market. We move through Maturana's necessity of living boundaries, McMurtry's undeniable metric of life value, and Galtung's tragedy of structural violence. We saw exactly how human institutions become blind, self-replicating autopoietic machines through procedural capture.
And we mapped out Dr. Saheli's solution, a civilization governed by corrigibility, by pluriversality, and by a relentless, unyielding focus on enlarging life capacity across medicine, economics, education, and our relationship with the earth. A universe of relations only becomes a civilization of care when unity is embodied as actual material responsibility.
It is the most profound shift imaginable. It is moving from seeing the world as a dead machine to be operated, to seeing the world as a community of legitimate others to participate with.
Before we go, I want to leave you with a final, slightly terrifying thought experiment that builds on everything we've discussed today. We talked extensively about how human institutions, corporations, hospitals, governments already act like blind, self-replicating viruses, optimizing for their own metrics and survival while ignoring the human beings inside them. We called it institutional autopoietization. Well, what happens when we eventually hand over the day-to-day management of those exact incorrigible institutions to autonomous AI agents?
That is a chilling prospect. We would be crossing the threshold into artificial autopoietization.
Exactly. If the human administrators are already ignoring the windshield to stare at the GPS, what happens when we remove the human from the driver's seat entirely? Will we witness systems that fundamentally write biological life out of the equation entirely, operating at the speed of light to maximize a proxy metric while the actual life ground collapses beneath us? Tomorrow, when you go to work, keep an eye on the systems you interact with. Notice the administrative boxes you are forced to contort yourself into. Look at the metrics you were asked to optimize and ask yourself, who is serving whom?